Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. 14 years ago, John Judis and Roy Teixeira wrote a book that shaped the way a lot of people think about how our shifting demographics might change American politics. They wrote The Emerging Democratic Majority at the Beginning of the Last Period of Unified Republican Control of Government. It was a bleak time for Democrats and the left. George W. Bush was flush with power following the 9/11 attacks. We'd invaded Afghanistan. The drums of war were beating for Iraq. And Republicans were talking about the possibility of having a permanent majority. Judis and Teixeira came along and basically said, enjoy it while you can, because a new majority coalition is on the rise. People of color, unmarried women, white liberals, they would join together to form what would in fact later be called the Obama coalition. But after the 2014 midterms, in which Democrats got a shellacking, in the words of Barack Obama, Judis and Teixeira parted ways. At least analytically, I think they remained friendly. But Judis decided that their analysis had been flawed. And he wrote that it was actually Republicans who now have a governing advantage. And central to his rethink was his view that the Democratic coalition needed to retain a certain level of support among white working class voters, the very people who put Donald Trump over the top 3 weeks ago. This is very timely, even though the book was written over a decade ago. Teixeira still thinks that the values of the left, broadly defined, will prevail in large part, but not exclusively, because of these ongoing demographic shifts. So the co-authors of this seminal book ended up in different places. At a time when the nation is so polarized, this is not just an academic debate. This week, we'll have Roy Teixeira and John Judis on to talk about the emerging Democratic majority and whether it's still something that is that you can take to the bank. But first, I want to talk a little bit about partisanship. There are a couple of storylines emerging from the 2016 election and its aftermath that I think should trouble us all. But partisanship can be blinding. And in that sense, both sides do it. Partisanship is blinding on both sides. Partisan loyalties tend to influence what we find outrageous and what we think is kind of meh. This week, the Washington Post reported that U.S. intelligence officials believe that their Russian counterparts were at least in part responsible for the proliferation of fake news that we've been hearing so much about. Fake news with a conservative bias. Now, reports like that should be taken with a grain of salt. These are unnamed intelligence officials. Just like those reports that claim the hacking of the DNC and the Clinton campaign were the result of Russian operatives. But we do know that Donald Trump has spoken with Vladimir Putin more than any other world leader. And we do know that Russia has been flexing some muscle of late. Its foreign minister said this week that the U.S. had to step out of the way in Syria and let Russia and the Assad regime have free reign. And even the possibility that Russia or other outside actors had intervened in our elections to such a active degree, such a direct degree. And I should say that it's not unusual for them to play games. It's not unusual for us to play games, things like funding opposition groups. This is things we do all the time. But to such direct, this kind of direct intervention should be something that all Americans find problematic. We should be seeing congressional investigations. We should be seeing a lot of bipartisan outrage, because the shoe could be on the other foot. But of course, Republicans are not going to risk exposing their new president as a Manchurian candidate. And they, as some on the left, have decided that this talk is merely an excuse for Clinton's loss or a case of sour grapes. They see it in partisan terms. Another story, it's become pretty clear that Donald Trump is using his new position as the head of the most powerful state in the world to promote his own business interests. This is before he's even inaugurated. Allegedly, he's been using calls with foreign leaders to smooth over, like, permitting issues for new construction projects and the like. Foreign officials are dropping loads of money in his D.C. hotel in kind of a not-so-subtle form of a not-so-subtle attempt to buy favor or at least access. He has said that he won't put his assets into a blind trust, as most presidents have, and I believe all modern presidents have. And this specter of corruption from the White House, from the Oval Office, is also something that should not be a left-right issue or a matter of partisanship. Conservatives should be just as worried about a president running the country for his own benefit as liberals, but it is not the case. So we're in uncharted waters here, and I find it genuinely troubling that half the country simply can't see a problem here. They don't think that these are issues. Partisanship isn't an inherently bad thing, but these are pretty glaring examples of how it can have a really deleterious effect on the health of our republic. Anyway, on that happy note, let's take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with Roy Teixeira. Stay tuned. I don't mind other guys dancing with my girl. Joshua, just wanted to give you a quick heads up that the first third or so of this interview with Roy Teixeira, the audio is a little bit rough. We tried to make it work with a cell phone. We lost him a couple times. We tried to get him back. Eventually, we took a break and got him on a landline. So all of those stops and starts were edited out. You will just hear some rough audio in the first third. It's audible. Bear with us. It gets better. Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm still Joshua Holland, and we're joined now by Roy Teixeira. Roy is a senior fellow at the Center for at the Century Foundation and at the Center for American Progress. Mouthful there. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, The Optimistic Leftist: Why the 21st Century Will Be Better Than You Think, which is timely considering that most leftists at this point, I think, are pretty pessimistic after the 2016 election. Roy, the last time you were on the show, it was called the Alternate Radio Hour, but since only the name has changed, I will welcome you back to the show. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Glad to be here.
So a week after the election, you wrote a piece at Vox.com titled Trump's Coalition Won the Demographic Battle. It'll still lose the war. This was an affirmation of the emerging Democratic majority thesis that you and John Judas offered in 2002. Judas has had a rethink, and we'll speak with him later on. We've heard a lot about how white working class voters proved decisive in the Rust Belt in 2016. Why do you remain confident that the Democratic coalition will ultimately win the war?
Well, I should clarify that by win the war, I don't mean they're going to win, you know, there'll be a point after which they'll win all the elections. That's really not the point. It's more about, you know, which strand of political thinking and policy orientation will actually wind up, you know, sort of having hegemony in America. And, you know, I definitely stick to my guns that I think the way the country is trending will mean that over the long run, you know, in fact, our politics will look a lot more like the politics of the emerging Democratic majority and a lot less like today's contemporary Republican Party or even, you know, the party that includes Donald Trump. So what I said in that article was just if you do a very simple estimation of the changes that we're likely to see in terms of the structure of the electorate going forward, within even 4 years, that would be enough of a change. If we held everything else constant, even the super high support rates from white working class voters in this election for the Republican candidate, they would actually lose back the three Midwestern states of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and they'd also lose Florida. I mean, that's not to say they will. It's just to say that the ongoing force of demographic change will continue. And obviously, in this election, the Republican Party didn't have to respond to it because they were able to take advantage of this populist surge that particularly affected these white working class voters and actually squeak out a victory. Of course, as we all know, they lost a popular vote by about 2 percentage points and 2 million votes. But thanks to this great system we have, Trump was able to take the presidency. But as I argued in that article, they're living on demographic borrowed time. The very voters that gave them super high support rates in this election will probably be declined by about another 2 or 3 percentage points as a share of voters.
So right now we're having a somewhat stupid debate about the role of so-called identity politics in the Democratic coalition. And the reason I say it's stupid is because there's a growing body of evidence that social group identity is a key influence on most voters' political preferences, right? That's of all stripes, conservatives, liberals. Essentially, all politics are identity politics in a way, and we only call it that when we're talking about people of color or LGBT or whatever. Republicans have engaged in white identity politics for as long as we can remember. But there's a non-stupid version of this argument, which says that the very emerging Democratic coalition that you and Judas identified in 2002, the diversity of that coalition is causing a backlash of explicitly white identity politics. And we can see that with the explosion of white ethno-nationalism in this country with the so-called alt-right. John Judas says that middle-class white office workers, that is, socially liberal whites with a college degree, are trending Republican because they feel that the Democrats speak to people of color and affluent liberals, but not to those folks right in the middle, the folks that think of themselves as ordinary Americans. And I'm not saying they are, but that's the way they see themselves. And that this is basically in part a reaction to the diverse coalition the Democrats have put together. What's your view on that?
Well, first of all, I mean, I should point out that that John Judas's thesis about the trends among white 4-year college degree voters doesn't actually seem to be borne out in reality. In fact, what we saw in this election was white college educated voters, including those with a 4-year degree only, shifted toward the Democrats, whereas the white non-college vote shifted very significantly away from the Democrats. But leaving that aside, that's just sort of an empirical observation. I certainly agree there's a stupid version of identity politics and that it's a non-stupid version, but I think one thing that people have a little bit of a hard time sorting out is whether and to what extent an emphasis on the views and the sort of the social transformations that are taking place, to some extent, if you bop people over the head with the idea it's a changing America, and you're not really like part of the vanguard, and you know, therefore, at least in their view, you're saying we don't really care that much about you and your experience. I mean, you will get a backlash, And you typically, and you'll definitely get a backlash, which I think we've seen, when there are actual material reasons why these voters might actually feel that they're not progressing very far in today's America. This is a very classic reaction, actually. If you look at the history of populism, that's really when it tends to come out in a big way. You get xenophobic populist movements when they're, you know, in the aftermath of financial crises and other and long-term economic trends that basically make people feel like they and their kids and their communities aren't making progress. So I think it's always very complicated. You can't reduce politics to identity politics, but identity politics is something that, you know, obviously crosses the race-ethnic divide. And you could definitely make an argument, it seems to me, that the left is better off when it's not like my identity politics versus your identity politics. There's unifying themes and a sense among a broad group of people across races that, in fact, the left knows how to make their lives better and actually could do it. I think if you just sort of divide up into opposing camps, that's not necessarily the best approach for the left.
This is a key point, because a lot of criticism of the EDM thesis is that it posits that demographics are destiny. What Teixeira is saying here is that it's not just demographics being destiny. It's also the fact that the Republican solution, the right-wing movement solutions for real and concrete problems such as growing inequality, setting aside things like climate change, are essentially non-existent. Roy, let me ask you about the flip side of that question. We want to belong to a coalition that looks like us, or that reflects our cultural values, our broader values in terms of egalitarian politics. Does the emergence of this so-called alt-right, which I think is a euphemism for white nationalism, does that bring people of color, single women, unmarried women, other parts of the emerging Democratic coalition, does that bring them closer to the Democrats? Because I'm not sure we've seen that play out in 2016, but I have the sense that it may do that moving forward.
Well, it certainly may, though, as you say, it didn't really pan out in the 2016 election, when I think Democrats were hoping there would be a tsunami of turnout and support by these groups who would be scared by Trump and the kind of politics that he seemed to be encouraging. But in fact, you know, the coalition performed acceptably in some ways. I mean, turnout was not great, but it wasn't terrible. Support was very, very good, but not, you know, at the transcendental level people were looking for. There just didn't seem to be, and in fact, as far as we can figure out from all indicators, there wasn't the enthusiasm among these constituent groups of the emerging Democratic majority that you would have thought you might see in an election like this with an opponent like Trump. So, I mean, I think down the road, yeah, it's possible people will be so freaked out by Trump that they'll suddenly snap to it and realize, oh my goodness, you know, wasn't as enthusiastic as I should have been about electing Hillary Clinton and stopping the Republicans. And now I've seen the light. But I think Democrats, you know, should realize, as the left in general should realize, that one component part of the level of enthusiasm that your coalition has for you is the extent to which they feel you can really solve their problems. And you are solving their problems. And I think we have to accept the fact that, by and large, the fact that the country has not performed well economically for the post-financial crisis period has to some extent sapped the enthusiasm, even the Democrats' solidest supporters. And it's done that, and it's also, you know, I think laid the groundwork for this kind of populist surge that we see, where there are big swaths of the population, in this case, they're white and they tend to be less educated, just seeing, you know, that something new has to be tried, the whole system's corrupt, let's blow it up. None of this is good for the left. So I think just as we, the left shouldn't have relied on, you know, sort of these groups to deliver the election for them by themselves in 2016, I think it would also be a mistake going forward to think that now they're going to be really pissed off and they'll deliver elections for the left. I think you've got to, you know, as Mao Zedong said so many years ago, you've got to walk on two legs, right? You've got to mobilize your emerging coalition and your strengths at the same time as you try to remedy your weaknesses and reach out to the more persuadable members of the group that, that you're weak among and that seems to be opposing you. And this is really, I mean, back to the emerging Democratic majority in a sort of classic version. When John and I wrote this, the piece, I mean, obviously a big part of it was demographics, that this is a critical and important thing that's changing America, and it's bigger than you think, and, it, and here's how it's going to happen. But we also argued that the Democrats were specifically going to have to combine that emerging support with a, you know, reasonably solid performance among white non-college voters, that if that went too far south, the simple arithmetic tells you that that could be enough to stave off these changes. And that we also made an argument in the book about how nothing is automatic. Nothing is going to happen just simply on the basis of shifting the underlying structure of the electorate, that it creates the possibility of a coalition that can have quite a bit of success, but you still have to organize that coalition politically, you have to shore up your weak points, and you actually have to perform. You actually have to improve people's lives. You have to have a policy approach that people find credible and actually works when you do it. So we said all those things in the emerging Democratic majority, but unfortunately, sort of the vulgarized version of the thesis was, you know, it just got boiled down to demographics as destiny, which I think for all too many people on the left seemed to mean, well, all we got to do is wait around long enough and everything will be great. You know, all the white working class voters will
wait
die
for the,
off and
wait for the,
whatever. We'll be in the cloak.
Right. Wait for Bill O'Reilly's audience to pass,
exactly.
And then we'll be in good shape. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Roy Teixeira about the emerging Democratic majority. Here's a question that's a bit complicated, and it springs from what you were just talking about. And you're going to have to give me a moment to frame it, because I want to bring three dynamics together. First, we know that Democratic constituencies don't turn out in midterm elections as reliably as a Republican coalition does. There's the combination of natural migration patterns and gerrymandering, and it's given the Republicans a significant advantage in the House. They control many state houses. So we've seen this patterns where Democrats have an advantage in presidential years. Republicans have an advantage in off-presidential years. This means that divided control of government is pretty likely. Second dynamic, the Republican Party, with apologies to Guns N' Roses, has shown an appetite for obstruction. And people tend to blame the party that controls the White House when things aren't running smoothly. We've seen that to a degree with Obama. People like him personally, but they're fed up with Washington, the direction of the country, etc. Finally, we have this very Democratic-leaning group of young Americans, the millennials. They skew Democratic in large part because the oldest of them came of age during Bill Clinton's presidency, which was seen as largely successful. The middle ones came of age during George Bush's presidency, which is an utter disaster. And then the youngest of them during Obama's presidency, again, seen as largely successful. So taking these three dynamics as a whole, can you not see a scenario in which young people coming of age over the next decade or so associate the Democrats with inaction or the inability to enact that agenda that you're talking about? Is it possible that we saw kind of a blueprint for the Republicans this year in terms of, you know, they control state houses, they can do voter suppression on the margins, and then in a broader sense, they can demoralize the Democratic base?
Well, all these things are possible. I mean, one thing to keep in mind, though, about the control Republicans currently exert over the levers of power is, you know, it's kind of like the Pottery Barn rule, right? You break it, you own it. So they own, you know, the sort of the policy output of the government. They own, like, how the country's going to evolve for at least the next few years. If you're coming of age, you know, in that sort of critical 14 to 24-year-old period, and you see what the country looks like when the Republicans are in control, and you see what actually they do and see what President Trump is like, I mean, it's equally possible that they'll just become even more, move even farther to the left than they already have, or certainly be very unenthusiastic about the Republican Party. So I think my expectation of the cohort replacement aspect of this, which is,
you know, the simple fact that these younger generations come into the electorate, they replace older generations who exit at the other end. It's not clear to me at all that this isn't going to continue to advantage the Democrats under the current configuration with the way politics is likely to evolve. The Republican Party holds a variety of social views that are anathema for these younger voters, and certainly we don't see like that's going to change under the Trump administration. And, you know, if unless Trump pulls a few rabbits out of his hat and all of a sudden America, you know, sort of enters a period of prosperous, well-distributed growth, I'm not sure that they're going to find the policy outputs of a Republican administration and a Republican-dominated political system as being all that great. So, you know, I mean, anything's possible. I mean, it could all go the other way, and they could build on, you know, sort of demoralizing and or even partially mobilizing these younger voters coming into the electorate along with their advantages from gerrymandering and geographic distribution and the relatively low turnout and off-year elections, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, they'll rule forever. But I'm doubtful about that, very doubtful. Things change, and I think the underlying advantages of the Democrats are likely to come to the fore. And as I say, I actually think it's quite important that the Republican Party has no real policy solutions that would actually improve people's lives. And people aren't, you know, this is very important. I mean, ultimately people judge you by your governance. And if they're viewed as being essentially not able to deliver when in power, this will hurt them.
Roy mentioned the views, the socially conservative views that make the Republicans anathema among young people. And what I think of when you said that is this piece that Ryan Lizza wrote for The New Yorker a few years ago. Maybe it was in 2013. It was called Where the Suicide Caucus Lives. A really interesting piece. He identified 80 Republican congressional districts that were deep red politically and very white demographically. Mm-hmm. And he said these members of the House basically represent like the Fox News viewership. They worry more about a Tea Party or challenging them in a primary than they worry about losing a general election campaign to a Democrat. And the point of the piece and the reason Lizza called them the Suicide Caucus is that they would not permit the Republican Party to adapt to changing times. They would not allow them to do immigration reform or to take less of a hardline stance on social issues. They would not let them support LGBT rights fully. And it is this group that keeps the Republicans so far and for the foreseeable future from adapting to changing times. And I think that's a key part of this equation that often gets lost in the debate over whether it's demographics or destiny or whether demographics are not destiny. Roy Teixeira, I believe we are out of time. I do hope that you'll come back and talk to us about your new book when it comes out this spring. When does it come out?
Comes out March 7th.
March 7th. Let's have you on in March. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Great to talk.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with John Judas. I'd buy you Rogaine. Welcome back to the show. I'm joined now by John Judas. John is a senior writer with National Journal and an editor in large at large for Talking Points Memo. John, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Glad to be back.
John has a new book out. It's called The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. We're going to have him back on the show in a few weeks to discuss his latest book, but today we're going to talk about an old one. So in 2002, you and Roy Teixeira wrote The Emerging Democratic Majority, a super influential book. It gave hope to Democrats and liberals at a time when the Bush White House was talking about a permanent Republican majority. In 2008, you looked prescient. The emerging coalition you identified swept in a black guy with a funny name into power, and all seemed well. But after the 2014 midterms, in which Democrats got a shellacking, in Obama's words, you wrote a piece for National Journal titled The Emerging Republican Advantage, and you argued that the so-called EDM, the Emerging Democratic Majority, was a mirage. What is it that you see now that you didn't see in 2002? Lay out your argument.
Well, let me give you the best version of it that won't make my co-author Rui unhappy. We saw in 2001 the development of a coalition in the Democratic Party that could become a majority. What we described then was something that and I even look back, the words was women, professionals, minorities, plus about 50% of the white working class, which had been the core Democratic constituency from the time of the New Deal. So we never envisaged a coalition that in which the Democrats would be getting, 26% or something of voters of who had, some college, white voters with some college or less. That's how they do it in the statistical. And, we said by the end of the first decade, there would be this majority would emerge. And it did. But it's pretty much disappeared is too strong a word. But what we have now really is a more of a unstable equilibrium in which the Republicans have a slight advantage, especially in midterms, but as it turned out in this election as well.
Now, you speak specifically about the middle class whites, the so-called office workers of the world. When you talk about non-college educated whites or working class whites, isn't it true that that Democrats haven't gotten 50% in decades?
Oh, they used to always get 50% in the battleground states. I think what we were referring to was if you leave aside some of the southern states where it was like 80-20 or something like that, they're getting 50 or better in a lot of, especially like states like Pennsylvania, Michigan. So yes,
okay, and
that's right.
And but
the groups that I just go back to what I was saying, the groups that after 2008 came into the Republican Party was more that had been before either on the fence or Democratic. In addition to the white working class, were the again, whites, but not exclusively whites, who had just a four-year college education. And, people who read these things start thinking about, Harvard or something like that. But, we're talking about four-year colleges. There's thousands of colleges in the United States and who usually end up office workers of one kind or another. And senior citizens who after 2008, and I think partly influenced by the way that the administration presented Obamacare as being paid for partly by slowing the growth of Medicare, seniors come into the Republican Party with a vengeance, and that's continued. And if you look at not at the presidential figures, but at the House races nationally this time. And, I don't have the final things, but the House coalition, was like 52-48 Republican this time, which again should be kept in mind when all these people are talking about how, you know, the Democrats still have a majority. And it looked more like the 2014 with not as pronounced in the white working class, but again, seniors and four-year college. So anyway, that's a long answer, but that's, but those were the groups that after 2008 came in addition to the white working class and really made it possible for the, you know, the Republicans to have this advantage, you know. And if you want me to go on, Yakov, I'll say one more thing. The other thing I'd say is that but I don't think we got this wrong in the book, because we didn't. I always thought to myself that there would be one of the parts of the coalition that in the future would be endangered was that Latinos wouldn't necessarily follow the same trajectory as Black Americans, who are like the Jews. They've been very loyal Democrats, regardless of income or occupation. You just go right up, you get the same percentages, and that, you know, we might find with Latinos the same thing that happened with the Irish and the Italians, et cetera, other immigrant groups into America, that as they move up, they're less likely to be sure Democratic votes. And that's been happening too, not in a profound way, but it's happening. And, you know, it really happens with a vengeance in places like Texas. Not in California, because of the labor movement there is so strong.
But
in other states,
I'm going to come back to that in a second. But a key part of the EDM was looking at the fact that the Republican coalition was getting older and not growing, and the Democratic coalition was younger and growing. The share of although non-college educated whites skewed overwhelmingly for Donald Trump in this election, their share of the electorate had declined since 2012. College graduation rates are going up. Some argue that this emerging Democratic coalition is coming, but that we concluded too early that it was here back in 2008. Your view?
Well, first of all, I don't believe in this majority-minority America. And it's, again, we go back to the same thing about the facile use of this term, people of color. I mean, you know that there is, again, the whole thing about races is just, it's political. It's not biological. There's no proof of it. It's not a...
It's a social construct.
It's a social construct. Very nice. And... again, this guy Richard Alba from NYU, I think, is very good on this. That if you look at Latinos and mixed marriages, their kids tend to identify as white. You'll find the same thing with with Asians, but I'm not sure.
I've been arguing for years that the majority minority thing is total nonsense.
So we're on
agree.
The same page.
But if you look at the census projections, right, they still see whites, all whites, that is mixed whites, people who identify as white Hispanics, are still going to decline as a share of the population.
Uh-huh.
They're not going to become the minority, but they're projected to
I agree with that, but that you're still going to have politics. You can't base your majorities on census calculations. That, I think that's the point I keep trying to make, and that the Democrats have to think of a way in which they can become the party of the average American and not of the poorest and the well-to-do, very educated. I mean, you know, Democrats now have this very unwieldy coalition, and Hillary Clinton really couldn't speak for America. I mean, Trump could do it much better than she could. I mean, everybody accused him of being a racist, but he there was still a way, and George W. Bush could do the same thing. The Democrats are really stuck. They've lost their tongue in terms of trying to capture this sense that they're speaking for Americans, and when you do that, you're not speaking for the wealthy, but you're. Bill Clinton did this. The people who worked and paid the bills, and you know, there was an expression. He was able to do that, and Obama to some extent, especially when Bill Clinton helped him in 2012, and he had Romney with the 47%. So they have right. Democrats have to recover politically that sense of not speaking for these, you know, this nonsense about a rising American electorate, but for, you know, for all people. So that's the key. It's political. And as long as they're seen as a party that's relying on these various identity groups, they're not going to be able to get groups that think of themselves, well, I'm not part of that. So that's really, in a simple sense, what happened this year in the election.
Well, that's a problematic thing because, you know, white people are an identity and they don't think of themselves as an identity. I mean, white people are not an identity, a discrete identity. There are many identities within whiteness, but being white is seen as a default. And, you know, if you take an African-American from, you know, out west and an African-American from the East Coast, one wealthy, one poor, they have a sense of shared identity from being African Americans in the United States, even though they may have disparate backgrounds. That's not the case with white people. There is no kind of white identity, but white people have their own identity. So you'll have like, I'm a Mets fan from Queens, and that's an identity, or I'm a you know, a good old boy from Alabama, and that's an identity. But let me ask you this, John. You talked about politics and the Democrats' failure to speak to this group. But Hillary Clinton won 2 million more votes in an election that saw hackers releasing her campaign's internal emails. It saw James Comey making an unprecedented move in discussing an ongoing investigation just 11 days before the vote. Doesn't the circumstances of this suggest that it's kind of like a black swan event, and we can't really generalize from Trump's victory with white working class people in the Midwest, because when are we going to run another candidate like Hillary Clinton with all of her baggage against another candidate like Donald Trump?
With all his baggage. You need to add that to the thing.
With all his baggage, but also his celebrity appeal and his ability to dominate the news cycle with Twitter. Like the media was not prepared to deal with Trump.
Okay, so you want me to comment on this so-called fictive majority of Hillary Clinton's? I'm happy to do that. Look, I think that the Democrats were hampered in this election, and she was, and another Democrat would have also been hampered by the third term problem, which is that they inherit all the grievances of the previous two terms of the party in power of Obama. And, you know, he's popular now, but you have to think of all these people who don't like one thing or another about him. And the person who's running, who wants to become president from the same party, can't represent him or herself as a candidate for change, because then they say they're going to get in trouble with the base of the party that supported Obama in this case. But if they don't, then they run into the problem that, oh, we're just going to see more of the same, and more of the same means something bad to a lot of people. So it's a real problem. And, you know, Nixon and Kennedy in 1960 would be a classic example of that, where Eisenhower was popular, but he still couldn't. But in a way, Nixon was crippled by that. And there are all kinds of stories about that, too, afterwards, about Eisenhower's press conferences and things like that. So that was a big problem. Let's put that to one side. election majorities, things like that. The Trump did not run a national campaign, and neither in that sense really did Hillary Clinton, but she had about 2.5 times more money than he did that he spent. We're not talking about his personal income, but that was raised and spent. She had, I'm sure, about twice as many ground troops working for her. Press-wise, I would say that the exposures of him, the audio tapes, the various investigations, were much more damaging potentially than the Comey stuff. I think they were about, let's say they were equal. I don't think you can say, well, you know, she had this bad publicity, but he had good publicity. They were about equal. So I don't think you can take her the popular majority thing seriously. And the one piece of evidence I put is, again, is the House races, where the Republicans actually come ahead 52-48. I worked it out. I think it's 51.4 for the Republicans. So that was a national vote, and that was a case where the resources were about equal. So, I would say that this election was very problematic for the Democrats. And again, if you go to the state races, the legislative races, again, you see real problems there. You know, I think it's Larry Sabato. I read this. It's the biggest drop for any political party in the course of 8 years in terms of all these races.
Go ahead, I'm sorry, John.
Yes. Anyway, so you get what I'm saying. That I don't think that you can take much solace from the fact that Hillary Clinton got more popular votes. I'm also, if you want me to do the other thing, I mean, some people say, well, Bernie Sanders would have done better. I don't agree with that.
Let's not get into that.
Okay.
We don't have time
I'm
for that.
I'm fine on that.
I've talked about that, and it's a counterfactual. You can never, you know, what's the point of arguing a versus counterfactual?
Oh, I can prove that one.
Well, first of all, I'm over time with you already, and I have two other things that I want to dig into.
Okay, that's fine.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with John Judis about his second thoughts about the emerging Democratic majority. John, before we go on, I just want to disagree a little bit about the Comey thing. For me, it was the timing, right? So that was
the
11 days before.
The Comey thing. Yes, the Comey thing damaged her. I would not
If the grab my blank had come out just before the election, we could say it was equal. There was time to recover in a way that there wasn't for Clinton. But Let me go on.
She might have won. And I guess the other thing I would say was that Trump, in view of it all, was a very vulnerable candidate. It wasn't like he was this incredibly formidable candidate. I mean, what people told me, beforehand, I think one union guy told me this. That he was the only Republican that she could beat, and vice versa. So it's there's some truth in that.
There is some truth.
And
in
I think the Comey thing was damaging.
Yeah, and you know, we did see people who decide in the last week broke towards Trump. Let's move on. So you guys, you and Teixeira talked about ethnicity and this demographic coalition. You didn't include the decline in religiosity that some other analysts have talked about. So if you talk, you mentioned Stan Greenberg earlier, right? He talks about a very similar coalition, but he also talks about nuns being religiously unaffiliated. He says regular churchgoers have always skewed heavily Republican. They're in decline as a share of the electorate. Alan Abramowitz, the Stanford political scientist, he talks about the core base of the Republican Party being married white Christians, which is a group in steep decline. People are getting married later. I'd like your thoughts on these theories. Is it possible that the emerging Democratic majority, as you defined it, was too narrow? And how much weight do you give to the decline in church going and the decline in Americans' religiosity?
Well, let me just say that I just edited an article at Talking Points Memo, and it might be on their website now about just this subject about and then there was the title is "And Then There Were Nuns," N-O-N-E-S, but
yeah,
about this
yes.
very subject. You don't know whether it's cause or effect, basically. It's been very concentrated among younger people, the rise of non-observance. I think that's the main thing, not so much whether people believe in God or not, but whether they're observant. And if you look at the polls, that's where you see the biggest correlation with the Democratic vote. And it's connected to this group, again, this younger voters who have been disproportionately Democratic, but unfortunately they're getting a little less, and Hillary Clinton had a lot of trouble with them. I just wouldn't take that as a single factor that would in the future lead toward a Democratic majority. I mean, you can look at Trump. I mean, anybody who believes that he's a faithful Christian has to be crazy. you know what I mean?
Okay.
He got a votes of evangelicals because I think he made promises to them, well, publicly, but I think he also privately assured those leaders that he was going to appoint people to the Supreme Court who would oppose Roe v. Wade.
And they also have an internal organizational capacity that, any kind of shortcomings in his campaign's ground game was made up for by, the conservative church's ability to turn out their own voters. I mentioned, and this was a good segue because I want to talk the last thing, and I'm going to let you go soon. You mentioned millennials, and you hear people say, well, demographics are not destiny. Gary Jacobson, a political scientist at UC San Diego, says it's not just demographics. He looks at millennials, and he finds that this group is not only more racially diverse than other cohorts, but he also talks about what's known as generational imprinting. Apparently, the era in which someone comes of political age influences their voting patterns for the rest of their lives. It's not the only thing, but it's a major influence. And he says that those who came of age during Bill Clinton's, George Bush's, and Barack Obama's presidencies, that's three in a row, skew Democratic. He doesn't say that people become more conservative as they get older. He thinks that's a myth. And he writes that younger Republicans, and I'm going to quote here, are less likely to consume conservative media and to share the beliefs common among their audiences. Compared with older Republicans, those under 30 are significantly less likely to watch Fox News, to believe Obama is foreign-born or Muslim, and to deny that human activity is heating up the planet. They are also less sympathetic to the Tea Party movement. Isn't this cause for optimism for the future?
Well, it depends entirely on the politics. You're assuming that the Republican appeal is going to remain exactly what it has been. And with Trump, it's already changing. Plus the fact you have to take into account now they're going to have the next generation is growing up under a Republican Trump presidency. And, I've seen those statistics, and the Reagan generation was tilted Republican. So maybe the Trump generation is going to tilt Republican too. George W. Bush didn't because of the Iraq War. I mean, and it was a disastrous presidency.
He was unpopular.
Right. So, and if Trump screws up, then this will continue. But if Trump screws up, then you are going to see a return of the Democrats. That's the condition for the other party to regain its hold is that one of them screws up, and that's really what the Democrats are going to be playing defense for the next 2 years.
Yes, very much so, and four years, I imagine, right? I mean, they have that midterm problem. John,
well, they
Judas,
didn't have it in
I believe...
2006. So
but that was because Bush, I mean, that was following Hurricane Katrina. That was,
well, I know, but we could have another. We could have Hurricane Donald, you know.
It's true, but we need to remember, but there was redistricting in 2010. But anyway, John, we are unfortunately about out of time. We're going to have you on in a few weeks to talk about the new book. In the meantime, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Okay.
Folks, before I let you go, I want to just ask a question. Do any of these debates we're having right now about what happened in 2016 and where we need to go from here really matter? I mean, right now there are multiple cross-cutting conversations or fights going on within the broad left. Some have embraced the stereotype that liberals have become out-of-touch coastal elites, say we need to show more empathy for voters whose economic distress led them to vote for Trump. Others are blaming Bernie Sanders for damaging Hillary Clinton during the primaries. Some are blaming the Green Party. There are those who are convinced that the Clinton campaign did itself in by focusing too much on Donald Trump's depravity and not enough on a progressive economic message. Oh, some are blaming the media or fake news. There's this raging debate that I mentioned earlier about so-called identity politics. Now, looking back, it was probably a bit of all of these things. As I said on a previous show, the election of Donald Trump was like a modern airliner coming down. Multiple systems had to fail. It's not just one thing. But my question is whether any of this matters, given that 2016 was what I would say is a black swan event. Of course, every election has its unique storylines, but I would suggest that we will never see a pair of candidates or a confluence of events that are even remotely similar to what we saw this year. We won't see another rich, belligerent reality TV star with zero experience run again, or at least not for the first time. He'll run for re-election in 2020. We'll probably never see a candidate with his ability to dominate the news cycle with a single semi-literate tweet. It's possible that Chelsea Clinton will run for president someday, but not anytime soon. We're not going to nominate another Clinton in the foreseeable future. In all likelihood, future Democrats won't pick someone whose favorability ratings are underwater, or someone who's been the target of a 30-year smear campaign by the right. I think it's safe to assume that they'll take cybersecurity more seriously in the future. Internal campaign emails won't be dribbled out for the final 6 weeks of an election. It's unlikely that another FBI director will break protocol and discuss an ongoing investigation involving a candidate 11 days before an election. So if this was a kind of once in a century perfect storm, an election unlike any that we'll see again, then it calls into question whether the postmortems matter. It calls into question the idea that Democrats need to change course or do something really different in the future, or that liberals have to do something different in terms of their relationship with the Democratic Party. The key may be as simple as nominating a popular candidate who isn't under investigation, not letting their emails get hacked, and trusting that the Republicans will nominate an experienced politician in the future, a Republican politician, the type that we know how to run against. This is just a thought to keep in mind. Anyway, I would like to again thank Roy Teixeira and John Judas. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever you find it. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I'd also like to thank Crooks and Liars, Digby at Hullabaloo, and the Smirking Trump, formerly the Smirking Chimp, for letting me host the show at their places. And of course, I'd like to thank you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week. Yo me vine para Brooklyn y he dejado mi país. Si me quedo